When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, Lit listeners, prepare for an epic journey into the heart of rock history with a living legend behind the lens, Neil Preston. In this exclusive Rock is Lit episode, we step into Neil's unparalleled career spanning nearly five decades, capturing the essence of musical icons like The Who, Bruce Springsteen, Fleetwood Mac, Queen, and more. As Led Zeppelin's only tour photographer in the mid-70s, Neil's lens witnessed the raw energy that defined an era. His lensmanship also extends into cinema, notably collaborating with his best friend for over 50 years, writer and director Cameron Crowe, on several of Cameron's movies. In fact, the duo's real-life adventures inspired the film Almost Famous, which Neil and I are going to talk about. And, of course, Neil will regale us with captivating tales from his 2017 photo book, Exhilarated and Exhausted, a fascinating retrospective of his career, with a killer foreword by Cameron Crowe. In the spirit of Rock is Lit's focus on the convergence of fiction and music, after all, it is the first and only podcast devoted to rock novels. Get ready for a deep dive into Neil's iconic photograph of Jimmy Page at Kezar Stadium in 1973, which is a photo that in many ways informed and plays a major role in my rock novel, Searching for Jimmy Page. You'll have to check out the novel to find out how. So whether you prefer your poison in a glass or words on a page, join us for episode 42 of Rock is Lit as we unseal the extraordinary legacy of Neil Preston.
Hi, everyone. This is Neil Preston, and you are listening to Rock is Lit. I'm not, but rock is.
Thank you so much, Neil, for joining me. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
I have been doing this podcast only about a year, so Rock is Lit is still a baby, but I've had a chance to talk to some really cool people like Danny Goldberg and Susie Quattro and Jim McCarty from the Yardbirds a couple times. And I have to tell you, and I'm not blowing smoke up your ass, getting you to come on the podcast is one of the biggest thrills I've had so far doing the show.
Aww. I know I'm a good photographer. I'm not the best in the world. I'm not the worst in the world. Okay? And I'm the first one to say that. My ego as a photographer, doing what I do and knowing the people I know, is like way down here. It's the pictures that people gravitate towards. The pictures mean so much to so many people that in the last 10 years, it finally hit me that A, I've created a huge body of work, but yes. B, that body of work is significant, and it's significant to a lesser level for historical value, but on a greater level for as far as I'm concerned, for the pleasure it brings the fans, the memories, the nostalgia, someone puts a print of mine up on the wall and they derive pleasure from it. That's how I get my cookies. I mean, because look, I can walk down the street and nobody knows who I am except for a tiny little slice of the entertainment world, rock and roll world, or my friends. I'm completely anonymous, but they'll know the pictures.
Yeah.
And that's what makes the difference. So
Like the best of both worlds then. Now you can walk down the street. You know, but speaking of having prints on the wall, I was interviewing a student who's going to be a Rock is Lit intern next semester, and we were doing a Zoom interview. Mm-hmm. And I love doing those because you can see what people have in their rooms. And behind her was a picture, a copy of the Freddie Mercury shot from Wembley Stadium in 86.
Oh, we're just bending back.
Yes. And I said, I'm getting ready to interview Neil Preston, who took that picture. I thought she was going to lose her shit. She was so excited because she loves Queen. She loves that picture. And she knew several of your other pictures. So, yeah, your work means a lot to a lot of people.
Well, it really does. But I trust me on this, and I'm a straight shooter, okay? I don't need to kiss anyone's butt. I don't need to have smoke blown up my ass or vice versa. And I'm as normal as they come. I talk to Jimmy or Robert or the man in the moon the same way I talk to you or the guy at the 7-Eleven, you know. But I've come to see, especially later, like I say, certainly the last 10 years, people ask me what I do. Oh, I don't like to lie. I'm a photographer. You know, well, what do you shoot? Well, I work in the entertainment business. Well, what do you shoot? If I actually tell them, they lose their minds.
Yeah.
Or it's my mom and dad, you say, because I come from a Broadway family. So my mom and dad called regular people civilians. You know, civilians cannot wrap their heads around what I do and what I've done. And to me, I understand why they think that, because they see the end result. I'm a music fanatic.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a fan. This is what Almost Famous is about. And I know we'll talk about the movie later, but it's about family and it's about fandom. And, you know, when a Stevie Nicks fan, it happens to come up here, comes to an exhibition and sees some of the stuff that they've never seen, they genuflect. I never dreamt in a trillion years that I would be known at all and that my work would be considered a significant piece of pop culture history.
Yeah.
Never. I mean, who thinks that when you're like 11. You know, I always thought I'd work in a camera store after I got my first camera about 12 years old or 13. I never dreamt I'd be doing anything like sitting here talking to you, talking about this picture and that picture. And, you know, I'm there to do my job. And when the lights go down, I'm on it.
You know, today is the 43rd anniversary of the death of John Lennon. So I sort of want to start there because I know that seeing the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show in 64 just knocked you on your ass. You write in your book that a nuclear bomb had exploded in my brain, delivered straight to my cortex by John Lennon. So tell me more. Yeah.
That's the best explanation I could come up with. I mean, when I was a kid, even when I grew up, my dad was a Broadway stage manager. So, and my nuclear family is my mom, my dad, both of whom passed away. My sister is still alive, who's older than me and lives in the UK, and me. So when my dad he was the stage manager for the original Camelot, My Fair Lady, The King and I, Fiddler on the Golden Age of Broadway musicals. So, you know, when he'd have a show in New York, we'd be in New York. And I went to first, second, third, fourth, and fifth grade in New York. Sixth grade, we were on the road. And when you're Actors Equity, which is the union that my dad belonged to, there are very strict rules for, and they're under the auspices of the New York State public education system. And they have very strict rules in that children in the cast of a touring show, the children of the crew who are also traveling, there must be someone in the cast who has a New York State teacher's license, who's licensed to teach in the state of New York. It's usually a chorus boy or a chorus girl, and they make extra money. When in February 64, that week we were in Boston. Now, and that was 1964, so I would have been turning later that summer 12. So I was 11 and three quarters. And, we always used to watch the Ed Sullivan Show. I didn't know. I vaguely heard the Beatles a couple of weeks before that. But
right.
I remember turning it on, and my life was never the same.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way to describe it other than a nuclear bomb delivered right within my cortex, right to the heart of the matter. And it was the music, the vibe, and what I considered the supreme coolness of John Lennon.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, why John and not Paul, George, and Ringo? But I'm with you on that.
John, suffice to say, you'll probably agree with me, the male race that got into the Beatles, although we all love the music, we would gravitate towards John, you know, this snarky guy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I never met John, but everyone told me he was a prick of pricks. So John Lennon, to me, was the epitome of cool. I mean, the music just got me. And, and I'd been exposed to all kinds of music when I was a kid, classical, Broadway. I'm probably the only person you'll ever interview that can name all 11 Gilbert and Sullivan operettas.
Oh, my.
Or most of them.
I bet you're
and,
right.
And my dad was big into classical music. And so pop music, I was always around showbiz and pop music. But I was transfixed by the Beatles that night. And the next morning, we were in Boston, and there's a very famous department store called Filene's, and in the basement they had cut rate stuff, and my mom took me there the next morning and bought me Meet the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And I have an original print of Robert Freeman's of the Meet the Beatles album cover. Yeah.
Well, so, I don't have a print of that, but I have the album framed on my wall because it was the first album I got too. I saw a TV, made-for-TV production, Birth of the Beatles, and had the same reaction you did. Just fell in love with the Beatles. It was John that grabbed me. He was my favorite, and I went out and bought the album the next day. I was 10 years old and been a Beatles freak ever since. So I dig what you're saying.
Yeah, well, for me, there's the Beatles and the Who and everyone else. There's John and Pete and everyone else. And I love a lot of bands.
Yeah.
But in my heart of hearts, my friends know if they come through the front door, they're going to be hearing Baba or Won't Get Fooled Again or something having to do with The Who most of the time.
Yeah, you were blasting The Who when we talked on the phone last month. I could hear it in the background. I don't remember which song, but I could hear it.
All of them.
All right.
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
So, yeah, so, but the Beatles were the, they were the, as Biden would say, the inflection point that changed my life.
Well, you mentioned Fiddler on the Roof a little while ago, and I think you took your first onstage photo at Fiddler on the Roof. You knew the play, so you knew when there would be laughter because you're not supposed to take photos. And at that perfect point, took your first photo.
I snapped one frame. Now, my dad being the production stage manager, you know, he every time it's so funny because every time once I was old enough to get on the subway to go from Queens into Manhattan, I'd usually take the subway in on Saturdays and see the Saturday matinee. And then in between the matinee and the evening show, my dad would take me to the Horn and Hard Art Automat, where you put the quarters in and you pull the sandwich out. It seems so quaint now. But I had my first camera and I remember taking it. And my dad would stand and stage right. And he would have a little booth with a microphone. He'd call the lighting cues. And he'd have a script. You know, he was in the wings. You couldn't see him. But I'd always stand next to him. And he'd always make sure he told me, you know, actors coming this way with a piece of scenery. So I pretty much knew when I could hang and when I get out of the way. But this one time I went to see him on Saturday. And the male lead, who I think must have been Zero Mostel, was sick. So my mom and dad's friend and my friend, an actor named Harry Gaz, was the understudy. So he took over the lead role that day. And I just, for some reason, I thought, this is my chance. And there was a speech that he would tell while sitting on a rock on stage right. So he was maybe, as the crow flies, 5 feet away from me, feet away from me. But I'd be tucked against the curtain so no one in the audience could see me unless I peeked around like that. And I knew when the laughs would come. So in the middle of a big laugh, I snapped one, maybe two frames. I think it was one frame. And and it took my life in my hands because that's highly, it's not that it's illegal, but my dad told me years later that he could have been socked with a $10,000 photo call bill from the Stagehands Union. Now, they loved my dad, so I don't know if that had anything to do. I don't think anyone heard the camera shutter other than me, but I was nervous as hell, but I got the shot. And I had the process. I still have the original slide here.
Really?
And I had some 5x7 prints made, which was what I could afford at the time. What was I, 14, 15? And my dad gave Harry Gaz one of the prints. And Harry gave my dad, as a gift for me, a set of, they looked like World Book encyclopedias, but they were all about photography. A collection of like 5 or 6 books about photography, and I devoured them. I've always been a voracious reader, and that's how I learned photography. I'm completely self-taught.
Well, you know, that story made me wonder, because you had to know the play. You had to know where the laughter was going to be. It made me wonder, can you shoot a band on stage if you've not seen them perform before? Do you need to have the experience of seeing them so you get a feel for their rhythm, for anything that they might do that you would want to shoot?
Well, that's a good question. Most of the bands I've shot, I had not seen before. Mm-hmm. I may have been familiar with their music. It was very rare that I shot a band whose music I was not familiar with. That would usually be an opening band, like, or some slop like Uriah Heep or Sorry, you guys. But you know what I'm saying? But
yeah.
But knowing the music is what helps. And knowing music. I took major music in school, and I'm well-versed in music. So all I can tell you is the first time I brought my camera to a concert with the idea of actually trying to make some good photographs as opposed to being a fan who, you know,
right.
springs camera. I don't know how I did it, but it just all made sense to me. On the back cover of my book is that quote, mm-hmm. which I love. Well, hang on, because this is important. I'm going to get lost. Hang on. Where are you exhilarated and exhausted? a title, by the way, which I love.
I love it too.
Yeah, well, the only person that didn't like it when I came up with it was my fucking publisher.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. That does not surprise me.
But well, I won him over, so it was okay.
Well, it says so much about what it's like to be a photographer with a touring band. I also love that you didn't put a musician on the cover. It's just this stage with Roger Taylor's drum kit on it. It's not a book about the musician. It's not a tell-all book. It's a book about what it's like to be a photographer on the road with musicians.
It's what it's like to create an archive of the magnitude of the one I created, which brings all that other stuff into play. So mm-hmm. here's the quote. Shooting live music is something few photographers do really well. I just discovered one day I was good at this because it felt natural to me. You can't teach it. You can't learn it. You just do it. The recipe is as follows. One part photography, one part love of music, one part a love of theater and theatrical lighting, one part hero worship, one part timing, and 95 parts instinct. And I thought, that's the only way to describe what I do. It just came to me naturally as an amalgam of all those things. The second I got my first camera from my first brother-in-law, I didn't know how to work it, but I figured it out.
It was instinctive.
It was completely instinctive. And to this day, I've never gone to photo school. So.
Oh, wow. Did you take any classes at all?
No, I was accepted to three colleges, but I was already being published when I was 17. I'd already been published. So when I graduated high school, I applied to three different colleges, which were NYU, Rochester Institute of Technology, which was basically funded by Kodak. It's more a technical course, how film is made and blah, blah, blah. And then Philadelphia College of Art. I'd been spending a lot of time in Philly. I had a lot of friends, and they had a good photography program. And that's where I decided I wanted to go, PCA. I was accepted to that school and the other ones as well. My mom and dad had put down a deposit on the tuition at Philadelphia College of Art. And I literally woke up one morning in that summer between high school and college. And I said, you know, I don't know about this. So I went into my mom and dad's bedroom. And our family was a tradition, especially during football season, lox and bagels. You know, every Sunday, lox and bagels. So I went into my mom and dad's bedroom and I said, okay, I'll go pick up the dry cleaning. I'll pick up the lox and bagels. I'm not going to go to college. I'll get the dry cleaning. And, you know, I tried to slip a curveball in there. And my mom said, whoa, wait a second. But as it turned out, I had a somewhat crazy uncle who was my mom's brother-in-law. But he was very bright, and he took my mom and dad aside, and he said, Neil's got photographic talent. And you should not discount that. And you should nurture that. And they kind of saw already what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So, so I didn't go to college. I graduated in 70. And then fall of 71, October 15, 71, I was on the Big Bird flying to L.A., moved to L.A. And here I am.
Yeah. Well, your photos, especially the live, the ones that you take on stage, nobody else's look like that.
You know what? Thank you. Because I will say that to stick up for myself. My stuff looks different.
Yes, it does.
It just does. And I've always known that.
Mm.
Why? I don't know. But I know that the pictures look different. They have... I'm not going to say they're more or less artistic. I'm going to say that they are the work of an individual photographer who I'm not a copycat.
No.
You know, I don't know how I do it. I instinctively know what light does, and, you know, and it all made perfect sense to me.
Well, I love...
So thank you. I call that a real compliment that you said.
Well, I mean it. Yeah, I love the way you use space, and your photos are so clean. And then there's something, so many of the photos, and I'm thinking of one in particular, and it's in the epilogue. It's of Jimmy Page. He's on stage. He's looking up, and there's a spotlight down on him, and it's like the glow of heaven shining on him. It's
oh,
heroic.
Is it the back cover?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
It's heroic, and that's what so many of the shots look like to me. These people who are our rock heroes come across that way in the photographs.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, heroic and to a certain extent romantic, which
yes.
is, I think, tied in with heroism and hero worship. And I've always felt that. I don't know what came first, chicken or the egg. If I imagine that that's the way I want to shoot it, managed to do it, or saw it was happening in front of me, it was happening right in front of me, and I managed to capture it, I don't know. But I always knew at the end of the day, when I would sit and look at my stuff, even off proof sheet and look at someone else's, they've got 35 out of 36 frames of someone just singing at the microphone. And I feel that what I've done, and I know I would never say I'm the best or the worst at anything, but I'm the best live music photographer in the world.
Yeah,
I believe that.
Yeah.
And I will, I'll go down the, you know, the Facebook rabbit hole and this rabbit hole. And if I see a shot someone did that's tremendous, I will write, fucking great shot, man. Pardon my French. You know, I will, I mean, I'm not one of those people that says, well, that's great, but I could have done it better. Well, I didn't do it. You did it. So I know a great shot when I see it.
Yes.
And I also like to say I've probably taken more bad photographs than most people in the world, but that's just a matter of pure volume. But I feel like, that's the last thing I'll say about my performance photos, unless you ask me another question, but I think that the challenge for me, ultimately, is to get that one photo that tells the story of that performance.
Yes. Yeah.
And I just came up with that rule of thumb a few years ago. So it's one thing to have a shot of Mick Jagger always like this or whomever. But there's just a way of getting the story of that gig. Mm-hmm. Whether it's Stevie Nicks shooting Lindsay, the If Looks Could Kill look, or if it's Robert with the Dove,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, that would be the story of that gig. You know,
talk about a happy accident with that. I wonder what that Dove shot would have been like had it landed on Jimmy instead of Robert.
Well, I always say that it wouldn't have turned out well for the Dove.
Oh.
Led Zeppelin came to my life very early.
When you were 22, weren't you?
I started working through Atlantic. I started working with them in 72, 73. So it would have been 21.
Oof.
And then I started working for them when I was 20. Let's see. Swan Song Party was 74, so 75.
75.
So I was 24 and a half when I started, or 23 and a half when I started. And I was their only tour photographer ever.
Did they ever tell you why you were the only one, why they never had anybody before?
Well, I knew why they had never had anybody. Well, let's put it this way. I didn't know why they had never hired an official tour photographer. I mean, they'd been photographed.
Mm-hmm.
But if you know anything about Zeppelin and Peter Grant, their manager, who was a real father figure to me, and he's the guy that held the keys to the kingdom, you'll know that he made a point, especially after they had hit a certain measure of success, not in the very, very beginning, but he kept them off TV.
Yes.
They didn't do this show and that show and American Bandstand and this and that. They did some stuff early on in 68, 69, but you essentially could not turn on the TV and see Led Zeppelin.
Mm-hmm.
Like you could see the Beatles or the Stones or whomever. And that was by design by Peter, which was brilliant. What ended up happening was in 1972, both Zeppelin and the Stones went on tour.
Yep.
And the Stones went on a very famous tour, and because it was the first big one after the Altamont fiasco. And they were getting a hell of a lot of press. It was the Rolling Stones, and they had this star and that star coming back. You know, Andy Warhol and Gay Talese and Mick is married Bianca. And it was like a star-studded, you know, they would receive the stars. Well, that didn't happen with Zeppelin. They were the opposite. They were cloistered. They were very cloistered. Or we had a very cloistered touring party. So you couldn't see them on TV if you wanted to see Zeppelin. You had to get yourself a ticket. Until then, they released the movie, which I don't think was a big hit at the time. But generally, you had to get a ticket, manage to get a ticket and see them. So at the beginning of, at the end of 74, when they started their own label, they had a launch party in L.A. and a launch party in New York. And my partner, Andy Kent, and I had a retainer deal with Atlantic Records from 72 to 74. The one main rule is that one of us, Andy or myself, because we shared in all the shoots and the money, one of us had to be available to Atlantic at all times in case they needed it. It's usually press parties, gold record celebrations, you know, Manhattan transfers, playing at the Troubadour, Led Zeppelin's playing along, you know. So I had gotten to know Peter a little bit through Atlantic, but I wasn't in the family. But Danny Goldberg was doing their press. Now, I knew Danny when I lived in New York when I was 17. Mm-hmm. Danny was a rock writer. And there was a new magazine that had started. I think it was either called Changes or Rock. Or no, he wrote for Circus, which the original name of that magazine was Hullabaloo.
Mm.
So I knew Danny from New York. So when I moved out to L.A. and he came out with Zeppelin in 73, he was doing their press. And they had the big launch party for Swan Song at the Bel Air Hotel. They had another one in New York, another venue. But I remember pulling Danny over and I said, and this was like November 74, October, November 74. And I said, hey, I know you guys are going out on the road January, if you decide you want a tour photographer, you know me a long time, because I'd love to throw my hat in the ring. Never in my wildest dreams did I realize that about a month and a half later, the phone would ring, and it was Danny, and he said, if you still want to come on the road with us, we want to hire you.
Wow.
And that's how I got the job. What had happened internally, and I'm not breaking any confidences because, you know, Jimmy's talked about this, and the Stones were getting all the press from 72, and then they had the big tour in 75. Led Zeppelin's going on the road in 75, and they're the biggest and baddest ever. And I have a digital Led Zeppelin book that you can find on the Apple iTunes store.
Okay.
It came out 12 years ago, way ahead of its time. 300 photos in there, many of which no one's ever seen. We shot some footage of all the Swan Song staff got back together in New York for this. Mm. Danny, Janine Safer, Sam, there was someone else, and me, and we had never all been in the same room since the end of Led Zeppelin.
Oh my goodness.
And it was really fantastic. And yeah. And the thing was that Zeppelin being cloistered and keeping the mystery was very, very suspicious of the press. It's no secret that Jimmy was apoplectic when the first Rolling Stone interview came out, and they panned right. the first album, then they panned the second album,
mm-hmm.
you know, which kids were buying, you know, by the ton. But the guy who broke through that was Cameron, because Cameron had interviewed Jimmy in 73 for an LA Times story. And Cameron was 15.
Well, you guys met in, what, 72, and he was 15, so 15, well, 16, somewhere around in there?
I think, yeah. I remember I was given an article that Cameron had written in the San Diego Door right after I moved. It must have been the beginning of 72. And my girlfriend at the time was a rock and roll PR girl, and she said, read this article. It was, I don't remember who it was about. But I said, yeah, it's pretty good. She said, the kid who wrote it is 14 and a half. So anyway, we met each other. And
at a Humble Pie concert.
At a Humble, where yeah. I apparently brushed him off because I was working.
What you wrote about,
you know, yeah. Yeah, he had kind of broken through. So when 75 came around, Zeppelin said, you know, we're not getting any fucking press because fucking Mick Jagger. It wasn't a jealousy, but
probably frustration.
But it was, you know, we're Led Zeppelin. We're right. not, we're not Led Cowpoke. And so the decision was made that they would open up to some press. Cameron got the Rolling Stone piece, and they had some other press on the road, but they would need a photographer to be able to service magazines for all these stories that were coming out, and to document, they never had anyone like that
mm-hmm.
to document the tour. So Danny told me I was hired. Now, I would not have been hired if Peter Grant and Jimmy Page hadn't signed off on it. Jimmy's band. I don't care what anybody says.
Look, I love Peter Grant. He trusted me. He took me under his wing, as did Jimmy. And, but Peter knew that being such a large guy, he was very imposing and could get his way just by kind of getting in someone's face and yeah. with that Cockney accent. And, you know, if you fucked up, Peter would spank you in a way appropriate for you. And I got spanked a couple of times. They were the biggest and baddest. And I knew that going in. However, there's no instruction booklet for a kid going on the road with any band, much less the biggest. And I'm sorry. Zeppelin and Stones both went on the road in 75. And I've said it before, and I will say it again. Led Zeppelin ate the Rolling Stones for lunch that year. I will, and you could print that banner headline.
Were you afraid of Peter Grant?
No. I was afraid of John Bonham when he was drunk.
Yeah, you told a story or two.
You know, it's funny because that story will get you a $20 million lawsuit victory now.
Whew.
When I got de-pantsed on the plane.
Yeah.
And that's another good line I have where, Bonzo was the nicest country gentleman in the world. But once he started drinking, bull in a china shop, and you literally would want to cross the street and hide if you saw him coming towards you if he was drunk. But he could be the nicest, nicest, nicest guy. Jekyll and Hyde. And the last night, for the benefit of your viewers, I will tell the story in a nutshell. But in 75, Robert got sick in the middle of the Chicago gigs. So they had to postpone one of the four Chicago gigs. They tacked it on to the end of that leg of the tour, and it was St. Louis show. So the last show of that leg, we flew from Newark, from the private terminal of Newark in the Starship to St. Louis, did the show. I hadn't slept in a month for many reasons, mostly stress, punctuated by copious amounts of cocaine. But in between, I was always careful when I was working to keep it at a bare minimum. But my thing is, and I've struggled with drug addiction in my life, as a lot of us have.
Sure.
And not wood, I'm cool now. But it was the boring moments, the in-between gigs, the 2 days off, till I was 50, Anyway, after the gig, all I want to do is go to sleep. We get in the limos. We do the runner to the airport. I take a blue Valium in the limo. I'm walking up the stairs of the airplane. I take a second blue Valium. That's 20 milligrams. I get up into the plane. I put my bag down. And I go to the bar to get a Coke and a little something to eat. And I take a third.
Holy shit.
Blue Valium. So, but I'm amped from, just work.
Yeah.
But I was going to get some sleep. So I go back to my seat. I'm starting to get a little woozy. 30 milligrams of Valium coursing through my brain and veins. And all of a sudden, John Bonham walks up to me and says, "Let's see your knob." The knob is British slang for
penis. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, "What are you doing?" I said, "Let's see your fucking knob." And he sicked three of the off-duty cops on me. Now, that wasn't a fight I was going to win anyway.
Yeah.
But, my Valium haze, all I know is about 30 seconds later, I am flat out on the floor of the Starship, stark fucking naked. And I look up to see a slightly bemused Jimmy Page looking at me, clearly not impressed with what he was looking at.
Oh, my God. I'm laughing.
Double, triple entendre.
Oh, Jesus. I'm laughing, but it had to have been terrifying.
It wasn't terrifying. It was embarrassing.
Yeah.
I mean, because this is, I don't know about females, but, men, boys who grew up in the British school system, whether it's public or Catholic or private, it's different. They fighting, underage drinking, it's a rite of passage,
Okay.
Ripping a kid's clothes off.
Lordy.
I was mortified at the time. I was embarrassed. Mm-hmm. But I realized later on that meant that I was in the club.
Okay.
That's what it meant.
So were things different afterward with you and Bonzo?
I think in my whole life I probably said 200 words to Bonzo.
Really?
When I had to.
Yeah.
Well, he had his own set of friends. Jimmy. I mean, I naturally gravitated towards Robert and Jonesy, Robert was just a big hippie, but they all accepted me with open arms. I still worked for Jimmy after Zeppelin. He did The Firm, and I worked with him on The Firm, and then Coverdale Page I worked on. I actually went on the road with them and directed their electronic press kit. And then the Outrider stuff. And so I was Jimmy's guy for a long time. Then they did the 40th Atlantic anniversary show at the Garden, and 40th anniversary of Atlantic Records. But during the days of Zeppelin, there's a lot to subconsciously manage on the road with a band like that, especially with those egos. And I don't mean in a negative way, but, you know, Fleetwood Mac, same way. Five very opinionated people. And same with Zeppelin. Four very, very, very opinionated people, plus Peter Grant, plus Richard Cole. And you know, Richard, boy, Richard came through for me one night, big time. We played a gig in Greensboro, North Carolina. I don't remember if it was 75 or 77, but I do remember we would have six limos at each gig, one limo for each band member, or seven, one for each band member, one for Peter and Tommy Hewlett or whoever the promoter was, and then one for crew, the traveling crew, the part of the crew that traveled with the band, which was me, Janine, the PR girl, someone from Swan Song, my dear friend Danny Marcus, who was the Atlantic Records talent coordinator, administrator. So he was the guy with the Amex card. And apparently there had been a riot outside the loading dock. And we would have to, you know what a runner is? Have you ever heard that term?
No.
Band plays a set. Crowd yells for an encore. Band, you know they're going to come out for an encore one or two. And during those encores, the whole touring party gets in the limos, in the rear limos, so that when the show's over, when A Whole Lot of Love's over, four band members put on their robes, walk to the front of the line of limos, get in their limo, loading the loading dock door goes open, whether it's the Forum or the Garden or Chicago Stadium or wherever, and then police escort to the airfield. And as Danny Marcus used to say, a lot of times, the crowd would still be yelling for more. We'd be on the plane ordering lobster. But in Greensboro, there was a semi-riot. And the limo drivers were afraid to actually drive through the crowd. They were petrified. And Peter went ballistic. And he said, I will buy these fucking limos off of you. Peter always had a lot of cash on for whatever reason. And at the end of the day, he threw the limo drivers against the wall. The band finished A Whole Lot of Love. There were two limos left. Peter got behind the wheel of the first one. Richard got behind the wheel of the second one. And I think I tell this story in the book. But the loading dock door opens and Richard... And I got my camera bag, and he throws me in the back, and I'm laying face down over the laps of four of the most stunningly beautiful women I've ever seen in my life. You know, and I'm 20-something, and I'm like, oh, my God, this is great. But I couldn't see where we were going. They took off. They outran the police escort.
Wow.
In two limos. So six limos worth of people. I don't know how many were in my limo. It must have been 20. I mean, there were four girls plus me over them, plus I think there was a jump seat, plus people were squeezed in the front, and Peter and Richard are driving, who are used to driving on the other side of the road
as
well. So, but when we got to the airfield, Peter did a victory lap around the plane, and I got out of the limo and I had, oh, and when Richard had pushed me into the limo, my bag flipped over, and all these lenses and rolls of film started rolling down the concrete ramp. And he helped me pick up every single roll of film, every lens, cursing me, words I've never heard to this day again. But he had my back.
Yeah.
He had my back. So, you know, I miss Richard a lot. Yeah. He's so good guy. But, you know, they were a bunch. Anyway, I know you wanted to ask me about Kezar.
Yes. When you think of Kezar, you think of Robert with the Newcastle and the Dove. When I think of Kezar, and honestly, Neil, I don't remember when I first saw that picture of Jimmy.
And it's the one of Jimmy with his arms
yes.
out like that.
Yeah, I mean, you were talking earlier about wanting to tell a story when you take pictures. Well, I did. I took that picture, and that was my own story that came out, because that photo spoke to me in such an incredible way. I mean, I had a visceral reaction to it.
No one's ever commented on that photo before.
Interesting. It is my.
Now, I love it, but you know.
Well, I wondered, you know, because the Robert Plant one kind of overshadows a lot of the other shots from that concert. What do you remember about that particular shot of Jimmy?
I remember I was on Jonesy's side of the stage.
Mm.
That's about all I can tell you.
Yeah.
Because it's funny, half the show I didn't get to shoot because, oh my God, it was, I don't know how much you know about Bill Graham.
I know he was a tough cookie.
He's a tough cookie. He promoted everything out of San Francisco, and he was the promoter, and he had a very, very, very bad temper. Great guy, as I found out later, in later years, but had a really bad temper. And for some reason, when we showed up, he didn't want me on the stage. And Peter and Bill got into it about me.
Wow.
I don't think I got on stage till Moby Dick, until like half the show is over.
Oh my gosh.
So, but I made the most of it.
You certainly did.
But I wasn't working for them. I was working for Atlantic in 73.
Yeah.
But, you know, Peter worked it out. But Bill, I've been the recipient of Bill's wrath twice when he was alive, and neither was fun. But we became really good friends. And
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
One of the big differences is that it was daylight gig,
mm-hmm.
which was unusual.
Yeah.
So you're not thinking about the lighting and the silhouettes,
right?
And the highlights and the shadows. It's a different world.
Yeah.
And it wasn't afternoon going into dusk, going into nighttime like Queen did in 86.
Mm-hmm.
It was a daylight show, so that was different. And everyone knows the story about the two cages of birds, you know, and they were released during Stairway, and that one bird did a slow burn around the crowd in San Francisco, which at that time was, you know, crazy. And he stuck his hand out. The bird landed on his hand. But Robert's a farm guy. You know, he grew up on a farm. So he's used to animals and all that. And, you know, there's another guy that shot a similar picture from further back, and it's in color, who's been trying to live off the famous Robert Plant dove shot.
Oh, my God.
And you can look it up, but mine's better.
Of course it is.
It is. I just, you know what? Happy accident. Happen to have the right focal length lens. Happen to have film in the camera. Happen to see the bird land. Happen to have the camera right here. Boom. Happy accident.
Well, that's an iconic shot. It's, you know, that's the one everybody thinks of with Kezar. But again, the one of Jimmy just speaks to me. It crystallizes so much of what I love about him, what I love about that band, that duality, that light and dark aspect of them, I think is captured in that shot. So,
well, thank you. But when you just said the phrase, it spoke to you, speaks to you. And when someone says that, I know I did my job.
Well, you certainly did.
The pictures I love speak to me. My favorite Led Zeppelin shot is not Jimmy drinking the Jack Daniels.
Speaking of that Jimmy Page Jack Daniels shot.
He was on my left. I was here. I had a Nikon with a 24 mil on my lap. And I was talking to someone over here. But I knew Jimmy was over there. And I was probably talking to some girl knowing me. Blah, 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 blah. And out of the corner of my eye, I see this bottle start to come up. And I literally did this. Forgot about it.
Yeah.
One frame. Forgot about it. It became the poster child photo for 70s excess. Rock and roll.
Well, I love that Jack Daniels didn't want to use that for publicity for them because he wasn't drinking responsibly.
No. They wouldn't even buy a... We wanted to sell a photo for the Jack Daniels to the corporate office. What better photo? Not drinking responsibly. Cut to 25 years later, they're doing a documentary about Jack Daniels and rock and roll, and they begged me for photos.
Well, there you go.
You know, so, but, you know, the thing about Kezar was the afternoon gig and the Doves and the San Francisco crowd and the hippies, and Robert was in his element because Robert's an old hippie, and it was, to him, it was Summer of Love all over again. Mm-hmm. That's what the white... I always thought the Doves, they were pigeons. Okay? It was just, if you look at the crowd shots from Kezar, I'm telling you, every third person's a dope dealer, without question.
Oh, wow. Still kind of talking about Zeppelin. There's an overlap. Yeah. An overlap with Almost Famous. And I want to make sure we can talk about that. And they...
Oh, yes.
One of the things that I saw it when it came out in the theater, and I was with my mother, and I remember just being so excited because I got all the Zeppelin references, and I was so excited.
Oh, there's a bunch of Easter eggs in there.
Yes. So let's talk about some of that. But I just rewatched the movie last night. I've seen that movie so many times, but I rewatched it last night for the umpteenth time. And tell me the backstory of that film, because I know that it had, in the beginning, it had a different title. It was a different story than what it wound up being.
Yeah.
So how did you get from that initial, I guess, more fictionalized version to what became really autobiographical?
I have a copy of the original.
Do you? A few months after Neil read the original script, Cameron gave him the shooting script. The story had changed, and the title was now Almost Famous.
But a lot of what's in Almost Famous, a lot, is lifted directly from his and my experiences on the road with a few bands, primarily the Allman Brothers. Which was the first big band that he and I toured with. But everyone thinks that Stillwater is based on Zeppelin. But it's not. It's still water. It's an amalgam. It's the band that has the two creative forces that sometimes there's friction between them.
Yeah.
Plant and Page, Keith and Mick. But it's more the Eagles, actually.
Think I never would have guessed that.
Yeah. But there's elements of all those bands. So it's specifically not about Led Zeppelin, but people think that it is because of us. I know that Cameron called me up, and he was just coming off of Jerry Maguire, which was a humongous hit.
Oh, God, yeah.
And he said two things. He said, this is our story. This is our story. Literally, his and mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, if you can deal with being in one place for 3 months, because Cameron knows I'm used to traveling around all the time,
right?
It, you know, we can write a letter to the union because you have to be in the union, yeah. And I think we can get you in. So I said, I'm doing it. So he and maybe the producer, maybe it was just him, wrote a letter to Local 600 of
Cinematography Guild. Yeah.
And it landed right on our friend Kim Gottlieb's desk, who was the second in command. Kim, we knew for years, had been a rock writer. She was married to this guy, Jeff Walker, who was a writer, then was PR for Island. And Kim was like, yep. So I joined the union.
Yeah.
And we started shooting this movie. And it was surreal. It was life imitating art, imitating life. And it was like being on a rock tour.
Wow.
Exactly like being on a rock tour for 3 months. Mind you, the only two people on that set who had ever met Lester Bangs were me and Cameron. You know, a lot of the stuff was exactly as it happened in real life. When the girl that plays the sister, Zoe Deschanel, in the movie, there's that scene where she leaves William, the kid, the records.
Right.
And says, listen to Tommy with a candle.
Yes.
And those records are all from Cameron's personal collection.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
The guys are playing the poker game, and they have the card on there. That's Eagles poker. That came from the Eagles. And the day we shot that, Cameron came running over to me and said, can you call? I had to call Larry Salters, who was the Eagles PR guy. And we got Glenn on the phone because Cameron wanted to make sure that every single nuance was perfect. The tape recorder the kid uses was Cameron's tape recorder.
Oh, my God.
You could see that tape recorder in shots that I have of Cameron interviewing Clapton and Jeff Beck and Burton.
That's amazing.
The bag that when the kid, the bag flips over and all the shit falls out on Fifth Avenue, that's Cameron's actual bag.
Oh.
That, you know, we used to be on the road for Rolling Stone. We'd have to share one room because Rolling Stone wasn't going to pay for two rooms.
Mm-hmm.
They still won't. And, you know, we used to do stuff that kids would do, like go through the yellow pages and make phony phone calls
to people.
But Cameron would then pack the yellow pages in his suitcase. And I'd say, why the fuck are you taking, you know, the Albuquerque yellow pages home? And he said to me, because I don't know if I'll ever be back here.
Oh, sentimental.
So all that was real. And certainly there's fictionalized stuff.
You know,
we got slammed a little bit because it's a bit of it's not a sanitized version, but it doesn't dwell on the drug scene and the sex scene, really. Mm-hmm. Scene meaning the vibe.
Yeah.
And, but so much of it is real. The scenes at the Hyatt, the Ryan House, it was like that. It was crowded. And the last night we shot at the Ryan House was the last time it said Continental Hyatt House outside. The next day they closed for renovations. It became a different hotel. And Nancy, who was Cameron's wife at the time, mm-hmm. Nancy Wilson, mm-hmm. took the last picture of me and Cameron in front of the Riot House after we wrapped at like 5 a.m. And I treasure that photo.
I bet you do.
It was my life. You know, yeah. I'm just not a character in the movie. Almost Famous is about music, the love of music, the importance of family, and what it means to be a fan. Those are the three pillars. And there's a speech that Fairuza Balk gives at the end where she's talking to Billy right before he goes out to San Diego, or I should say Russell Hammond, where she said, and this always got to me, where she says to him, "Do you have any idea what a little piece of music that no one cares about can mean to someone like me or my friends?" And that says it all.
Yeah.
It's about a fan. As I like to say, if Pete Townsend was walking on my balcony, I'd be cutting this thing off so fast it would make your head spin. But that's me, you know? The other thing I want to say about Almost Famous, Cameron won an Oscar for original screenplay and mm-hmm. deserved it.
Yes.
At the night of those Oscars, so it must have been 2000, because we shot in 1999 and the movie was released in 2000. He had won the Oscar and I was on a shoot in Miami Beach or Miami shooting Dave Justice, who used to play on the Atlanta Braves. I've done a lot of sports too.
Yes.
I get back to my room and I turn on the Oscars and I know that he's up for an Oscar, and all of a sudden the winner is Cameron Crowe. And what? And I see him walk up to the podium and he's clearly nervous at the mic, and the only people he blanked out, the only people he could remember to thank were his mom and me.
Oh.
And when I got back to L.A., these are the days of answering machines, 50-some-odd messages from people all over the world. Yeah. I heard your name on the Oscars, you know. But
that's wonderful.
You know, it's a completely original screenplay, and there's a certain young lady that I know you've spoken to named Pamela DeBar, who to this day has tried to co-opt all the work that Cameron put into that movie, saying that he stole an idea from her. And it is patently untrue. And why she keeps saying this, I don't know. There are different generations. I know Cameron read her book. I haven't read her book, but last I heard, she didn't write for Rolling Stone, but she didn't have the family Cameron had. She didn't have the life that he had or we had. And I like Pamela as a person, but she's got a can with the whole Almost Famous is stolen from my book. It ain't true. It is not true. It never was true. It never will be true. And I'm here to stick up for my guy. And because he deserves it. So with all due respect to Pam and her husband, Michael, it ain't true. But Almost Famous is, it says, everyone thinks there's this existential thing where everyone thinks they're the star of the movie of their own life. But Almost Famous, between Almost Famous and Spinal Tap, the story of my life. Spinal Tap makes me laugh. Almost Famous makes me laugh and cry.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, it's so real and I was there for all of it. So it's pretty wild. And one thing you'll like is that one of the concert scenes, I think it was at the Palladium, we did one take of the wide shots of Stillwater on the band. And all the kids in the front were doing this, mm-hmm. like Ozzy.
Yeah.
So Cameron had to go up between takes and tell everyone, "We love you. The enthusiasm is off the chart, but this wasn't invented in 1973. Well, I'm going to surprise you with something. The T-shirt scene. Well, first of all, I worked for days and days trying to get what
the right shot where Billy was in focus and the other band members were not in focus. Mm-hmm. 2 days before we're supposed to shoot, Cameron came to me and said, I got it. He said, I got it. I said, what? He said, Bad Company, Burning Sky. He knew that I'd know what that cover was. So for my 50th birthday, my friend Randy Woodside, hi Randy, who was the gaffer, had stolen the t-shirt off the set at the end of the shoot day. Now, they always have two or three spares in case one gets damaged. That is the t-shirt from the scene. And there's Woody gave it to, he had stolen it for years to give it to me for my 50th birthday, one of my closest friends. There's a lipstick stain here. Don't know where that came from. There's a mustard stain on the back from Dodger Stadium.
Oh, but man.
I'm not big on memorabilia, but I had to. That is the shirt, baby.
Wow.
How about that?
I love it. There is so much humor. I was laughing out loud when I was reading the book.
Thank you.
And I wrote down so many quotes. Your writing is really, from one writer to another, you're a hell of a good writer, dude.
And you know what? And that I appreciate more than anything. I mean, I can't tell you, because I've had writers. I mean, thank you. That warms the cockles of my heart. I mean, I know some of the pictures are great. I know, you know, the pictures are the pictures. But I wanted the book to be me.
Your personality comes out. It's not just the stories, it's the writing and the humor that comes through and the voice. It's called voice. You have an incredible voice as a writer.
Well, thank you. My friend Chet, who is a big fan of mine, says, it's a fucking movie, bro.
Yeah.
It's a movie. Now,
and you're
movie
making
has
one.
Well, we're making a documentary. A movie has to, you know, I know a lot about movies from working on all the Camerons, but I'm proud of the writing when someone says, because people don't, you know, they look at the pictures and they never really, they'll tell you they read the book, but, oh yeah, I read the first page. I didn't really read much else. And I tell them, it'll take an hour, but you will get it. Mm-hmm. My favorite line is, when the show's over, get out of the roadie's way. It's not worth getting impaled by a forklift just because you want to impress some girl from Memphis who you'll never see again. And
yes.
I speak from experience.
I'm so glad you liked the book, because
I loved the book. I did.
It's just me. So
yeah.
So we're turning it into a documentary. I told you that. It's probably a year away. We've been gathering a bunch of, obviously there's not a lot of footage from the 70s of me working. I mean, I've got the odd shots of me in this one and me in that one, but, you know, we've found enough footage to be able to help tell the story in real time without me having to be on camera. I mean,
yeah.
There's a lot of audio of me. And, but it's really exciting.
Good.
No one can do it. No one can or has done anything like this, because it's the deep dive down into the rock tour world without going into the sordid aspects of it.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, the stress, the deadlines. I mean, my life has been a series of deadlines. Being on a rock tour, it's not the 24/7 drug and sex orgy that people think it is. It's the exact opposite. It's stressful. You have no sleep. The deadlines, whether they're film deadlines, print deadlines, deadlines because George Michael wants to go to fucking India.
And he had to get the little curl straight before he could do the
photo
shoot.
I watched George Michael by the clock 33 minutes
in his suite in Philly. I did the last Wham tour. It was seven gigs. Third gig was in Philly. I wanted to quit. All he did was fuck with the little curl. He couldn't get it right. And he was getting really fuzzy. And look, that's part of the deal. Everyone says, God, you must have so much fun with Led Zeppelin, all the drugs and babes and everything. And what I tell them is, I had much more fun with the REO Speedwagon. Which I did. I know Kevin.
I'm not even going there.
And Queen. I mean, I did six tours with Queen, and Brian's a very close friend of mine. And boy, those days were.
This was magical. Well,
I hope you enjoyed it.
I did. I had a blast.
Rock is lit. It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.